If you'd like to open your Bibles and follow along with the lesson this afternoon, we will be in Judges chapter 9. We've made it to chapter 9 after we have looked at the book's introduction and some of the first few judges that are given to us. We've studied Othniel and Ehud and Shamgar and Deborah and Gideon. And that leads us to Abimelech, who we will see is not a judge, although he wants to be a leader. He's sort of a self-appointed king, is what we'll come to find out. But really, Abimelech's story is part two to Gideon's story, because everything that Abimelech is has a lot to do with who Gideon was. If you remember in Gideon's story, in Judges chapter 6 through 8, we noted how Gideon started with somebody that was sort of timid. He was a man that was threshing wheat in a wine press because those Midianite raiders kept coming in with their camels and taking all the stuff. And the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon and told him that he was a mighty man of valor, and God made him into that. And Gideon was very successful in delivering the Israelites from the Midianites. And God patiently built up his faith. But you remember at the end of that story that the nation wanted to make Gideon into a king. And Gideon said in chapter 8 and verse 23, "I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you." And he was totally wrong about that on both accounts. Gideon said that he wouldn't be a king, but after he said that, he went on to tax the people, and he went on to build a monument that the people worshipped. He collected a harem of wives and concubines, and he even was so bold as to name his son Abimelech, which literally means, "My father is king." So Gideon could say all he wanted that he wouldn't be a king, and he wouldn't rule over them, and "my son will not rule over you." But for all intents and purposes, Gideon did rule over them as a king. And what we'll see is that his son Abimelech does the same thing. We'll see now what Abimelech does after Gideon is gone. So here is our roadmap for this afternoon, and we'll begin by just sort of introducing this section with verses 1 through 4 of chapter 9. So Judges chapter 9, beginning in verse 1. "Now Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, went to Shechem to his mother's relatives and said to them and to the whole clan of his mother's family, 'Say in the ears of all the leaders of Shechem, which is better for you, that all 70 of the sons of Jerubbaal rule over you, or that one rule over you? Remember also that I am your bone and your flesh.' And his mother's relatives spoke all these words on his behalf in the ears of all the leaders of Shechem, and their hearts inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, 'He is our brother.' And they gave him 70 pieces of silver out of the house of Baal-berith, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless fellows who followed him." So what we see is that when Gideon is out of the way, that Abimelech immediately starts campaigning. And Abimelech was born to be a politician. I mean, when we start to see the kinds of things Abimelech does, it is shockingly relevant to the things that we see around us. But Abimelech starts to campaign on this platform of being the hometown boy. You know, who do you want to reign over you? You want some outsider, or do you want somebody from Shechem to be your king? And he's, of course, the son of this great, respected military leader, Gideon. And so based on those two things, he wins the affections of the people of Shechem, and they decide to accept him as the king. Reminds me a lot of David's son Absalom, who, it says, stole the hearts of the people of Israel. And Abimelech seems to be doing the exact same thing here. And what we see is immediately after he is elected, he immediately proceeds to commit financial fraud. They give him these 70 pieces of silver, and he puts those in his pocket, and he goes and he hires these reckless fellows to be with him. And so political corruption has been a story as old as time. But here is this worthless man surrounded by worthless people, and he's the one that the people have trusted to be their leader. So look at what happens next in verses 5 and 6. Verse 5 says, And he went to his father's house at Ophrah and killed his brothers, the son of Jerubbaal, 70 men on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, was left, for he hid himself. And all the leaders of Shechem came together and all Beth Millo, and they went and made Abimelech king by the oak of the pillar at Shechem. So Abimelech goes straight to murder, not off to a great start. He's a man that is thinking like a king. You know, if your father was the king and you want to claim the throne as king, then it makes a lot of sense to eliminate all the competition. And so Abimelech had 70 brothers, and you know what? One of them might have had just as much claim to the throne as he did. And so as he's thinking like a king and as he's thinking selfishly, he decides that those brothers need to be eliminated. Now, remember, Gideon said he wouldn't be a king. But I want you to notice how Abimelech embraces the title. Abimelech doesn't even like try to pretend that he's not going to be a king. They say they want to make him a king, and he says, great, that's what I want too. And in a lot of ways, Abimelech is like Gideon, just without the mask. He is what Gideon was, just without pretending to be something different. So Jotham, the one who escapes, tells this parable. And let's look at this parable beginning in verse 7. When it was told to Jotham, he went and stood on top of Mount Gerizim and cried aloud and said to them, listen to me, you leaders of Shechem, that God may listen to you. The trees once went out to anoint a king over them, and they said to the olive tree, reign over us. But the olive tree said to them, shall I leave my abundance, by which God and men are honored, and go hold sway over the trees? And the tree said to the fig tree, you come and reign over us. But the fig tree said to them, shall I leave my sweetness and my good fruit and go hold sway over the trees? And the tree said to the vine, you come and reign over us. But the vine said to them, shall I leave my wine that cheers God and men and go hold sway over the trees? Then all the trees said to the bramble, you come and reign over us. And the bramble said to the trees, if in good faith you are anointing me king over you, then come and take refuge in my shade. But if not, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon. Now, therefore, if you acted in good faith and integrity when you made Abimelech king, and if you have dealt well with Jerubbaal and his house and have done to him as his deeds deserved, for my father fought for you and risked his life and delivered you from the hand of Midian, and you have risen up against my father's house this day and have killed his son, 70 men, on one stone, and have made Abimelech, the son of his female servant, king over the leaders of Shechem, because he is your relative. If you then have acted in good faith and integrity with Jerubbaal and with his house this day, then rejoice in Abimelech, and let him also rejoice in you. But if not, let fire come out from Abimelech and devour the leaders of Shechem and Beth Millo. And let fire come out from the leaders of Shechem and from Beth Millo and devour Abimelech. And Jotham ran away and fled and went to Beer and lived there because of Abimelech, his brother. It's a pretty colorful parable that Jotham tells, and it really gets the point across. And this is a fun fact for Bible trivia. This is widely thought to be the first parable in the Bible, a story where you have these characters that are fictional, but they stand in to teach a spiritual truth. But Jotham tells this parable, the parable of the trees. And basically what happens in this story is that the trees wanted to appoint a king, and so they go to all the trees that would be fit to be king of the trees. They go to the olive tree and to the fig tree and to the vine, but all of those trees are too busy doing productive good things to actually serve as rulers. And so they're left with the bramble. And they go to that bramble in verse 14 and say, you come and reign over us. And look at the bramble's response again in verse 15. Well, if in good faith you're anointing me king over you, then come and take refuge in my shade. But if not, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon. There's a few things that stand out to me in the bramble's response. For one, he seems pretty untrusting of the people that he's about to rule over, which makes for a tense kind of situation. Seems pretentious, self-centered, self-serving. And there's also a lot of irony there in verse 15. Come take refuge in my shade. I don't know how many bramble bushes you've seen in your life, but the ones that I have seen don't put out just a whole lot of shade. So if you could imagine somebody finding a thorn bush and thinking like, oh yeah, that's a good shade tree, and kind of sliding underneath it to get some shade, that's kind of the picture. It's ridiculous. It just doesn't make sense. And if you tried to get shade under a thorn bush, you're probably going to get all dirty and you're probably going to get scraped up in the process. And Jotham gives the explanation of the parable in verses 16 through 20. And basically he says, if I'm missing something and Abimelech is the rightful ruler of the people and you've chosen him for good reasons, then great, rejoice. But Jotham has his suspicions that that is not the case. And the last statement that he makes ends up being a very prophetic statement. He says in verse 20, let fire come out from Abimelech and devour the leaders of Shechem and Beth Millo, and let fire come out from the leaders of Shechem and from Beth Millo and devour Abimelech. That is almost literally fulfilled by the end of this chapter. And so the picture here is a picture of people and a ruler who really deserve each other. The people are no good and the leader is no good. And it's a situation that makes for disaster. So, as we keep reading here in verse 22, it says, Abimelech ruled over Israel 3 years. And God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the leaders of Shechem. And the leaders of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech, that the violence done to the 70 sons of Jerubbaal might come, and their blood might be laid on Abimelech their brother, who killed them, and on the men of Shechem who strengthened his hands to kill his brothers. And the leaders of Shechem put men in ambush against him on the mountaintops, and they robbed all who passed by them along that way. And it was told to Abimelech. So as you might expect in a situation like this, Abimelech's reign doesn't go very smoothly. He rules for 3 years, and then there's real tension between him and the people that he's ruling over. And it tells us in verse 25 that it's not even safe to travel the roads. That's how badly things have devolved under Abimelech's reign. But in verse 23, it tells us something that might seem a little difficult. It says that God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the leaders of Shechem. And we think, wait a second, that doesn't sound like something God would do. God doesn't tempt anybody to sin, we know that. But it's not the only time that we read something like that. In 1 Samuel chapter 16 through 19, a harmful spirit from the Lord tormented Saul. But here's the thing that I think that we need to understand about what's going on here, and also in 1 Samuel. And that is that God is not tempting Abimelech. He's punishing him. Same with Saul. Abimelech has made his choice to be a selfish, conceited, violent leader. And God is letting him reap the consequences of that. He's chosen to serve himself. He's chosen to be violent. He's chosen to not serve the people that he's entrusted to serve. And the situation that arises out of that is a situation of division and mistrust and treachery. So God is not tempting Abimelech, but this evil spirit is sent to punish him. But as we keep reading here in verses 26 through 29, now we see that people are starting to talk about how bad things have gotten under Abimelech's watch. Verse 26 says, and Gaal, the son of Ebed, moved into Shechem with his relatives, and the leaders of Shechem put confidence in him. And they went out into the field and gathered the grapes from their vineyards and trod them and held a festival. And they went into the house of their God and ate and drank and reviled Abimelech. And Gaal, the son of Ebed, said, who is Abimelech? And who are we of Shechem that we should serve him? Is he not the son of Jerubbaal? And is not Zebul his officer? Serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem, but why should we serve him? Would that this people were under my hand. Then I would remove Abimelech. I would say to Abimelech, increase your army and come out. So notice that as things sort of devolve in Israel and in the region around Shechem in particular, people are starting to chirp about that. And this guy named Gaal shows up, and he's apparently charismatic. He's somebody that the leaders put their confidence in. And I just want you to notice how fickle popularity is. One minute, everybody's ready to put a crown on Abimelech's head. The next minute, some dude named Gale just waltzes into the city, and they're ready to trust him. And so there's this festival that takes place, and it seems to me like Gale gets a little inebriated at this festival, and as inebriated people do sometimes, he starts to talk a big game. He says in verses 28 and 29, "Who's Abimelech, and who are we of Shechem that we should serve him?" And he says in verse 29, "Would that this people were under my hand, then I would remove Abimelech. I'd say to Abimelech, increase your army and come out." He's picking a fight, and he's picking a fight that's not a wise one to pick. Also, notice that he mentions Zebul in verse 28, and that's going to end up being his downfall. Zebul is this ruler of the city, and he doesn't take kindly to being portrayed as just a puppet of Abimelech. So look at what happens in verses 30 through 41. "When Zebul, the ruler of the city, heard the words of Gale, the son of Ebed, his anger was kindled. And he sent messengers to Abimelech secretly, saying, 'Behold, Gale, the son of Ebed, and his relatives have come to Shechem, and they are stirring up the city against you. Now, therefore, go by night, you and the people who are with you, and set an ambush in the field. Then, in the morning, as soon as the sun is up, rise early and rush upon the city. And when he and the people who are with him come out against you, you may do to them as your hand finds to do.' So Abimelech and all the men who were with him rose up by night and set an ambush against Shechem in four companies. And Gale, the son of Ebed, went out and stood in the entrance of the gate of the city, and Abimelech and the people who were with him rose from the ambush. And when Gale saw the people, he said to Zebul, 'Look, people are coming down from the mountaintops.' And Zebul said to him, 'You mistake the shadow of the mountains for men.' Gale spoke again and said, 'Look, people are coming down from the center of the land, and one company is coming from the direction of the diviner's oak.' Then Zebul said to him, 'Where is your mouth now, you who said, who is Abimelech, that we should serve him? Are not these the people whom you despised? Go out now and fight with them.' And Gale went out at the head of the leaders of Shechem and fought with Abimelech. And Abimelech chased him, and he fled before him. And many fell wounded up to the entrance of the gate. And Abimelech lived at Arumah, and Zebul drove out Gale and his relatives so that they could not dwell at Shechem." All of the smack talk doesn't go so well for old Gale here. Zebul doesn't take too kindly to being portrayed as a puppet of Abimelech. And another irony of the story is that Zebul is upset about being called Abimelech's officer, so he acts as Abimelech's officer. There's just sort of head-scratching corruption all around here. But he sends word to Abimelech, and Abimelech gives him this plan to divide his soldiers into four companies and to lay in wait overnight and then to attack at first light in the morning. And I just love this exchange between Gale and Zebul. The way that this is written, you can almost picture like this comedy skit, you know, taking place. Where Gale is like, you know, stepping outside the city, he's got his coffee in his hand, he's rubbing his eyes, and he's like, "Are those people coming down from the mountain?" And Zebul says like, "Oh, no, you're mistaken, that's not people." So he takes another sip of his coffee, and he rubs his eyes again, and he's like, "Okay, no, I'm sure that I see people coming down." And Zebul says, "Aha, it is people. Go out there and fight him. Where's your mouth now?" And so Gale goes out there with these men of Shechem and just gets whipped. And Gale gets driven out of Shechem. And Abimelech is lurking outside of the city. And this kingship is not working out very well for the people of Shechem at all. This leader that they entrusted themselves to, whether we're talking about Abimelech or Gale, both of those were terrible choices. And because of that, their situation has become terrible. And so look at how this continues to devolve in verse 42. "On the following day, the people went out into the field, and Abimelech was told. He took his people and divided them into three companies and set an ambush in the fields. And he looked and saw the people coming out of the city, so he rose against them and killed them. Abimelech and the company that was with him rushed forward and stood at the entrance of the gate of the city, while the two companies rushed upon all who were in the field and killed them. And Abimelech fought against the city all that day. He captured the city and killed the people who were in it, and he razed the city and sowed it with salt." You know, at this point, there's not a foreign enemy that's terrorizing Israel. It's one of their own. God has raised up one of their own to be the one that is holding them captive and enslaving them and terrorizing them. Their partnership resulted in mutual destruction. And as we see, as we continue on, that here it says the city was captured, it was completely leveled, it was sowed with salt. That's serious destruction. They don't want this to ever be rebuilt again. And when the people are holed up in this tower, the leaders of the city are holed up in this tower as their final refuge, we're going to see Gideon takes that away from them as well. Let's keep reading here in verse 46. When all the leaders of the tower of Shechem heard of it, they entered the stronghold of the house of El-Berith. Abimelech was told that all the leaders of the tower of Shechem were gathered together, and Abimelech went up to Mount Zalmon, he and all the people who were with him. And Abimelech took an axe in his hand and cut down a bundle of brushwood and took it up and laid it on his shoulder. And he said to the men who were with him, What you have seen me do, hurry and do as I have done. So every one of the people cut down his bundle and following Abimelech, put it against the stronghold. And they set the stronghold on fire over them, so that all the people of the tower of Shechem also died, about 1,000 men and women. You know, this story reminds me a lot of Abimelech, or reminds me a lot of Gideon in chapter 8. Remember in chapter 8, in verse 9, it says that when Gideon came to the men of Penuel, he said, "When I come again in peace, I will break down this tower." And then in chapter 8, in verse 17, he broke down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. Over and over again, we see how Abimelech mirrors Gideon. But again, Abimelech does it with less of a disguise. He's just more open. And here we see the finale of this terrible partnership between Abimelech and the people. In verse 50, then Abimelech went to Thebes and encamped against Thebes and captured it. But there was a strong tower within the city, and all the men and women and all the leaders of the city fled to it and shut themselves in, and they went up to the roof of the tower. And Abimelech came to the tower and fought against it and drew near to the door of the tower to burn it with fire. And a certain woman threw an upper millstone on Abimelech's head and crushed his skull. Then he called quickly to the young man, his armor bearer, and said to him, "Draw your sword and kill me, lest they say of me, 'A woman killed him.'" And his young man thrust him through, and he died. And when the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, everyone departed to his home. Thus God returned the evil of Abimelech, which he committed against his father in killing his 70 brothers. And God also made all the evil of the men of Shechem return on their heads, and upon them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal. So Abimelech moves on from Shechem to Thebes, and he attempts to recreate the same kind of victory that he had at Shechem. And it culminates in a situation that's very similar. The people are holed up in another tower, in another city. And what ends up happening is the curse of the parable is fulfilled. Just like Jotham said, let fire come out from the people and fire come out from Abimelech and you mutually destroy each other. That's exactly the conclusion of this story. What's fascinating about this, though, is Abimelech's final request backfires for him. You know, he says in verse 54, after this woman throws a stone on his head, he calls to his armor bearer and says, "Hey, would you please go ahead and kill me, because I just don't want people to say that a woman killed me." Well, look in 2 Samuel chapter 11. I love this. 2 Samuel 11, many years later, when Joab sends a message to David. 2 Samuel 11 in verse 20. He says, "Then if the king's anger rises and if he says to you, 'Why did you go so near the city to fight? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who killed Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal? Did not a woman cast an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died at Thebes?'" So even his final request is not fulfilled. And at the end of this story, we see that not only was Abimelech an embarrassment to Israel's history, but his legacy was an embarrassment to himself. And he was remembered for the very thing that he would dread to be remembered for. So, with that story being told, let's consider a few applications from Judges chapter 9. And the first is that children often resemble their parents, just with less of a disguise. I think I've shared this a few times at different points, but one of the final conversations I had with my mom when she was in her deathbed in Birmingham, Alabama, was I wanted to know what advice she had for me as a new parent. I just said, "Mom, you have been wonderful. You tell me, how can I be a good parent like you?" And one of the last things she said before she stopped being communicative was her response, where she said, "Just remember, they're always watching." I think about that all the time. Remember, they're always watching. The truth is, children see their parents for what they really are. It's easy for me to put on a good face while I'm here a few hours a week, but you guys don't see me at my worst. You don't see me when I'm stressed or anxious or tired. You don't see my failures, but my kids do. And the truth is that children see their parents as they really are. They see you as you really are when you have your guard down. And they often imitate what they see, except just more openly than the way that you might display those same traits. I was talking to Rob not too long ago, and he told me that Maria once said, "If you want to know what someone is really like, teach their first grade child." I think there's probably a lot of truth to that. Because you see children emulate their parents, both in the good ways and in the bad ways, and it's a huge responsibility. But for those of us who are parents, we need to take this to heart and see the impact that Gideon had on Abimelech. If we speak hatefully, then we shouldn't be surprised to hear our children doing the same thing. If we're lazy, we shouldn't be surprised to see our children be lazy. If we're materialistic, or we're lustful, or if we let work or hobbies take the priority in our lives, if we never read our Bibles, if we never pray, we shouldn't be surprised if our children follow in our footsteps. Remember, Gideon said the right things, but Abimelech did what his father did, not what his father said. I would suggest this also goes for any kind of leadership. This is something that's on my mind a lot because I am the father of young children. But the same thing would be true for any preacher or elders or deacons or husbands or even friends to keep in mind. That if people are looking to you for leadership, don't be surprised when you start to recognize some of the things that you see in them. They'll start to talk the way that you talk, and they'll start to think the way that you think. And that's a huge responsibility. They will start to resemble you for better or for worse. But a second point that I think we can take away from this is that the best leaders are the ones who are most eager to serve. You know, Abimelech was really eager to be king. He really wanted the power, not so much serving the people for their benefit and for their welfare. You know, when Jotham told that parable of the trees, remember, his point was that the ones that were most fit to be the rulers were the ones that were most busy doing good things. Whether it was the olive tree or the fig tree or the vine, they were all too busy doing good things. But it was the bramble who had nothing better to do. And so he's the one that jumped at the opportunity to grab power. I'll suggest that we ought to be wary of people who are too eager to lead. Sometimes there are people that are just always eager to jump up and be the one that's in charge and be the one that makes the decision and get in front of everybody else. Well, if their motives are selfish, they're not going to be very good leaders. I think about Moses. Do you remember what it says of Moses in Numbers chapter 12? It says that Moses was very meek, more than all the people who were on the face of the earth. We might think that a good leader can't be meek. A good leader can't be somebody that's gentle and quiet. He needs to be loud and he needs to be bombastic and he needs to be somebody that just, you know, says it like it is, no matter who it hurts or who it offends. But people like that are often more eager to serve themselves than others. Think again about the role of husbands. In Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 23, it says, "The husband is the head of the wife." Now, does that mean that husbands get to jump up and down and say, "Yes, I'm in charge, I can do what I want"? She has to go along with it. No, the two verses later, Ephesians 5:25 says, "Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her." The best leaders are the ones who are most eager to serve, to put the people that they're leading ahead of themselves, to sacrifice for them. Same would be true of parents. The same would be true of elders. In 1 Peter chapter 5, we see Peter express the same kind of sentiment to elders. 1 Peter 5 and in verse 1. "So I exhort the elders among you as a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, as well as a partaker in the glory that is going to be revealed, shepherd the flock of God that is among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but willingly, as God would have you, not for shameful gain, but eagerly, not domineering over those in your charge, but being examples to the flock." I think I've said this before, but the idea of a shepherd is not somebody who drives from the back, but somebody who leads from the front. And oftentimes the best shepherds are the ones who are not the most eager to serve, but the ones who quietly, slowly come around to the idea because they love God and they love his people. But number three, who we choose to follow will determine our destiny. I've made this point a couple of times, but Abimelech and the people really deserved each other. The people were attracted to Abimelech as a leader. The qualities that they found attractive in Abimelech were ultimately the qualities that led to their own destruction. I don't want to get too political, so let me just say this. Can we all agree that this country has elected some real stinkers over the past few decades? I mean, I don't care what side of the aisle you want to look at. I don't care what kind of name you want to put in your mind. But just over the past several decades, we've chosen some real stinkers in this country. And our country is probably worse off for it. But see, there are consequences of choosing bad leaders. If those are the kind of people that our country or our society lifts up and admires and says, "Oh yeah, that's a great person, that's a great leader, that's who we want to follow," then we ought not be surprised when that has negative consequences. But you know what's a lot more important than our country's leaders is our spiritual leaders. And if we choose to follow spiritual leaders that are stinkers, then we ought not be surprised when it has negative effects on us as well. If we choose to follow people who are shallow or foolish, they'll tend to make us shallow and foolish. If we choose to follow people who are humble and sincere, they'll tend to make us more humble and sincere. Remember what Paul said in Philippians 3:17. "Brothers, join in imitating me and keep your eyes on those who walk according to the example you have in us." The more that we spend time around people that have a love for the Lord, the more that we're going to have a love for the Lord cultivated within us. But ultimately what Paul says is, "Be imitators of me as I am of Christ." And ultimately that is the choice that each one of us has to make. Each one of us has to choose whether we will follow Christ or anybody else. And it's that choice that will determine our destiny. I'll close by reading Colossians chapter 3, verses 1 through 4. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 1. "If then you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory." If you want to seek the things that are eternal, seek the things that are above. If you want to seek the things that will last, seek the things where Christ is. What this verse is reminding us of is that if we choose to follow Christ, then where that leads is living with him forever in glory. Who you choose to follow will determine your destiny. There might be somebody here this afternoon that needs to make a decision to follow Christ. We want to make sure that you know that you have an opportunity to start on that path before you leave. If there's somebody here that's struggling with some sin, if there's something you want to confess, if you want to ask for prayers, ask for help, this is a great opportunity to do that while we're together too. But if we can help you in your walk with the Lord in any way, please come to the front. Let us know how while we stand together and sing.